Hi, this is Yo, host of Raw Talk, and welcome to part two of a special presentation of the God Delusion Debate, a debate about the very existence of God between Richard Dawkins and John Lennox. It's a fascinating debate that I think you'll get a lot out of, and we're just going to dive right into part two of this debate. If you missed the first half of the debate, it is available for free online at m88.org. And now, here's the second half of that debate, the God Delusion, on Raw Talk, here on M88.
Professor Dawkins, my next excerpt, we're going to change gears to some extent, to the fourth thesis, which is that Christianity is dangerous. I think you'll like this quote. It comes from the very first page of the book, from the preface. You write, and I have a few excerpts to read. You write, imagine with John Lennon a world with no religion. Imagine no suicide bombers, no 9/11, no 7/7, no crusades, no witch hunts, no gunpowder plot, no Indian partition, no Israeli-Palestinian wars, no Serb-Croat-Muslim massacres, no persecution of Jews as Christ killers, no Northern Ireland troubles, no honor killings, no shiny-suited, bouffant-haired televangelists fleecing gullible people of their money. God wants you to give till it hurts. Imagine no Taliban to blow up ancient statues. No public beheadings of blasphemers. No flogging of female skin for the crime of showing an inch of it. You then write, on page 303, that even mild and moderate religion helps to provide the climate of faith in which extremism naturally flourishes. And finally, you write on pages 307 and 308, more generally, and this applies to Christianity no less than to Islam, what is really pernicious is the practice of teaching children that faith itself is a virtue. Faith is an evil, precisely because it requires no justification and brooks no argument.
This is supposed to be a debate, and I feel intensely frustrated. I'm going to reply to what Lennox said about the crucifix. Who created God? I mean, the word created was smuggled in by somebody else. I didn't, or maybe I did say who created God. That's not the point. The point is not whether God is a created thing or not. The point is this issue of simplicity, which you rightly went on to talk about. In order to understand the existence of complexity, we can't just postulate complexity. We have to go back to simplicity. Now, John used the illustration of an archaeologist, wasn't it, who found some scratches on a cave, and it was supposed to be a powerful argument that said, well, these scratches are very simple, but the person who did the scratching was complex. That's nothing to do with the argument I'm putting. The argument I'm putting is that if we're trying to explain complexity, we need some kind of an ultimate explanation for the existence of a complex object, an improbable object. Certainly, the scratches on the cave are simple, and certainly the human that made those scratches is complex. If you went to another planet and you found some scratches which indicated the existence of life, we would both postulate the existence of a complex living being. But we would both need an explanation for where that complex living being came from. And I put it to you that just to say it was always there, or it just happened, is precisely the kind of non-explanation which creationists accuse evolutionists of erecting. They say, how could an eye come about by sheer chance? Well, of course an eye couldn't come about by sheer chance. It has to come about by a gradual, incremental process from simple beginnings. Exactly the same is true of anything complex. And a God, you can't just duck the issue, you can't just evade the issue by saying God was always there. You still need an explanation. So it tells you nothing to say that the scratches on the wall are simple. And by the way, the idea that physics is complex because it's difficult, that's a confusion of the two meanings of the word simple. Simple meaning easy to understand, and certainly modern physics isn't too easy to understand, but there is a sense in which it's simple in the way that biology isn't. Now, I haven't got much time to deal with the...
I'll give you a couple of extra minutes.
Well, no, sorry, I didn't mean to steal that. Let me come on to the thing about Christianity being dangerous. The reading from the preface, the quote from John Lennon, "Imagine no Taliban," no, and all that, that I think is self-explanatory, and I won't go into that. I think what I will do is zero in on the particular point of the third quotation, I think it was, which was about children and the evils of teaching children that certain things are true without evidence, teaching them that faith is a virtue. I would not for a moment say that all religion is bad, all religion is dangerous, all Christianity is dangerous. Certainly, only a minority of religious people are bad or do bad things. The point about teaching children that faith is a virtue is that you're teaching them that you don't have to justify what you do. You can simply shelter behind the statement, "That's my faith," and you're not to question that. What I'm objecting to is the convention that we have all of us bought into, whether we are religious or not, that religious faith is something to be respected, something not to be questioned. And if somebody says, "That's my faith," then you simply have to respect it, tiptoe gently away, and say nothing more. In most cases, that's quite harmless. But if you are the kind of person who takes your faith really literally and who believes that Allah has ordered you, or it would be the will of Allah that you go and blow somebody up, then it is the fact that you were educated as a child in a madrasa to believe implicitly in the faith that you were taught and not to question it, which, if you happen to be of an unstable turn of mind, or if you happen to be of a violent turn of mind, leads to the sorts of terrible acts which are done in the name of religion. I must stress again, I'm not saying that the majority of religious people do terrible acts. I am saying that faith is a terrible weapon because it justifies the performance of terrible acts, which do not have to be justified by reason or evidence. The one gift I would wish to give to any child is skepticism. Don't believe something just because you're told it. Don't believe something because it's your tradition. Don't believe something because it's in a holy book. Look for the evidence and question skeptically. And if everybody did that, we wouldn't be suffering some of the terrible things that are going on in the world at the moment.
Once again, this is the God Delusion Debate. That was Richard Dawkins. And coming up now, once again, is John Lennox.
I dearly love to come back on the first one, Richard. I think there's a slight obsession with the simple to complex. If you're building a factory, say, for manufacturing computers, they'll dig a hole in the ground first. That's very simple. And it gets more complex as it goes up. But everything comes from the mind of the planners. And what I'm talking about is inference to the best explanation. And the inference, when we look at the semiotics, say, of DNA and the fact that it carries a biological message, so to speak, to an intelligent designer, seems to me to be much more sensible than the inference to mindless processes that we do not know can do any such thing. But that's a big debate, and we've both written about it, and you'll have to be referred to the literature. Because I want to come to this topic about Christianity being dangerous, and I want to agree very largely with a lot of what you say, the danger of fanatical religion that fans the flames of violence. And quite frankly, I'm ashamed as a Christian of the reputation, particularly in the Middle Ages, the Crusades and so on, that they're associated with Christianity. But I'd like to point out that the perpetrators of that kind of atrocity were not following Christ, but they were actually disobeying his explicit command, because he prohibited, very famously, as you know, his followers from using physical weapons. "My kingdom is not of this world," he told them. He told Pilate. And it's very interesting to my mind, that Christ was actually put on trial for being a fanatical terrorist. That's very easy to forget, and he was publicly exonerated from the charge by the Roman procurator. Truth cannot be imposed by violence, particularly the truth that Christ had come into the world to bring a message of God's love and forgiveness. So I would agree with you, and the danger of training children to be fanatics by not allowing them to question is a very serious one. And I'm so glad that I had parents who encouraged me to think, and part and parcel of the Christian faith was that thinking. Now, you ask us to imagine with John Lennon a world without religion. Well, I'd like you to imagine with John Lennox a world without atheism, with no Stalin, with no Mao, with no Pol Pot, to name the heads of the three officially atheistic states. A world with no gulag, no cultural revolution, no killing fields. I think that would be a world worth imagining too. And I must say, I am very disturbed in your book by what seems to me to be an attempt to airbrush out the atrocities of the communist world. I've spent a lot of time visiting that part of the world, and I don't recognize anything that you say. Atheism was not peripheral to Marxism. For Marx, the criticism of religion was the foundation of all criticism. And so it concerns me that a scientist who's very interested in historical science in the sense of evolutionary biology unraveling history is content with a very superficial analysis of the period of the Cold War. And even more disturbed to read things like this, even if we accept that Hitler and Stalin shared atheism, they both also had mustaches, as do Saddam Hussein. So what? Well, yes, all three of them had noses in common with the rest of us. But what kind of reasoning is this? We're not talking about shared characteristics in general, but the motivating ideology that drove these men to murder millions in their attempt to get rid of religion, whether Jewish, Christian, or anything else. So I'm very disturbed at your historical analysis. You write that you don't believe there's an atheist in the world who would bulldoze Mecca or Chartres or York Minster or the Cathedral of Notre Dame. But what about the thousands of churches that were demolished in Stalin's Russia and the forced transformation of them into museums? Now, I can understand why one would want to rewrite the history of the 20th century to airbrush out the role of atheism, because one could very easily draw a parallel between the anti-religious agenda of the new atheists and the attempt of communism to obliterate religion. That's not going the right way, I think. And I'm sure that you would be rightly insulted, and I wouldn't suggest it for a moment, if I were to say that because you and Stalin were atheists, that you would have approved of the ruthless elimination of millions. You rightly expect me to differentiate between atheists. I would like you to write another book in which you differentiate between religions, because they are not all the same. Some support fanaticism, others don't. And then finally, you contend that the teachings of moderate religion are an open invitation to extremism. Well, that is not true of the teachings of Christ. I can't speak for other religions. But what about the moderate teaching of atheism? I've sat beside a young girl of 13 in the GDR who's just been told as the brightest child in the school that she cannot have any more education since she's not prepared to swear public allegiance to the atheistic state. I would call that intellectual murder. And it was committed many times in the name of atheism. But according to you, it's far worse than bulldozing buildings. But you say there's not the smallest evidence that atheists do such things.
I never.
But there is. But perhaps I've misunderstood
you.
Do you want to take a moment?
Well, I'm very happy to give up on the next one.
Which would you prefer?
I'm very happy. I'd like right, Richard to choose what he wants to do, because I've made some strong statements.
In The God Delusion, I very deliberately made very little of all the individual evils of religion. I mentioned them occasionally, but I didn't go on about the Crusades, the conquistadors, anything like that. I am not trying to say that religion, that religious people do bad things. I agree fully that Stalin and Hitler and Pol Pot and Mao did terribly bad things. It may even be that atheism was an integral part of the Marxism which led them to do terrible bad things, if indeed it was their Marxism that led them to do bad things. What interests me is that I think that there is a logical path from religion to doing terrible things, and I kind of touched on it in the last answer when I was talking about faith leading you to do things. There's a logical path that says if you really, really, really believe that your God, Allah, whoever it is, wants you to do something, you'll go to heaven, you'll go to paradise if you do it, then it's possible for an entirely logical, rational person to do hideous things. I cannot conceive of a logical path that would lead one to say, because I am an atheist, therefore it is rational for me to kill or murder or be cruel or do some horrible thing. I can easily see that there are plenty of individuals who happen to be atheists, maybe even individuals who have some other philosophy which incidentally happen to be associated with atheism. But there is no logical path. Those young men who bombed in the London subway and the buses, those 19 men who flew planes into various targets in the United States in September of 2001, they were not psychopaths. They were not downtrodden, ignorant people. They were well-educated, rational people who passionately believed they were right. They thought they were righteous. They thought they were good. Their religion, by the lights of their religion, they were good. The same thing could be said of the hideous things done by the Taliban, the oppression of women. These people believe deeply in what they're doing, and it follows logically, once you grant them the premise of their faith, then the terrible things that they do follow logically. The terrible things that Stalin did not follow from his atheism. They followed from something horrible within him. Christopher Hitchens has made the point that Stalin was, in effect, a new czar of a country which, for centuries, had been brought up to believe that there was a semi-divine king, the Tsar, and it would have been madness for Stalin not to have exploited this cringing loyalty in the peasantry that had been for centuries subjugated to the Tsars. It would have been madness for Stalin not to have done that. It would have been madness for Hitler, whether or not Hitler himself was religious, and there's some dispute about that. There's a good case to be made that Hitler was religious, but I don't care whether he was or not. The fact is that Hitler's terrible deeds were done by Christians who were. I think I'll leave that. I mean, I think even that's not relevant. The point I would return to yet again is that you will not do terrible deeds because you are an atheist. You may not for rational reasons. You may well, for very rational reasons, do terrible things because you are religious. That's what faith is about. That's what faith means. I suppose you could say that there was a kind of faith that motivated Hitler's followers and Stalin's followers as well, but that's a separate point.
Let's have a brief response. We do want to get through all of the topics tonight, but Dr. Lennox?
Well, I would want to argue that there's a logical path from any ideology. From any ideology that's fanatical and oppressive to the kind of behavior you say, whether it's religion or atheistic, because atheism is a faith, of course, as well.
It's not.
Of course it is.
Well, okay.
Don't you believe it?
You're an atheist with respect to Thor and Wotan and
yes, that's
Zeus.
Right. I don't believe them, but you believe atheism.
No.
It is your faith.
I'm in exactly the same position with respect to your Yahweh, your Jehovah, whatever you call him. I'm in exactly the same position with respect to him as you are with respect to Zeus. And I cannot imagine not believing in Zeus leading one to do terrible deeds. It's exactly the same with not believing in God.
I'm going to wrap this up. I mean it now this time, Dr. Lennox. If we're going to get to the rest of the debate.
Yes, let's go on.
All right.
Let's go on. I think the issue has nothing to do with Zeus and so on. They're non-existent deities. The issue is to do with two alternative...
Okay.
It's to do with two alternative explanations of the universe, and each of us have our faith. I believe there is a God behind this universe. You believe the universe is all there is. The cosmos is all there is. Those are both statements of faith.
Okay.
You have evidence you believe for them.
The fifth thesis...
How could a belief in the cosmos lead you to murder?
We have a time limit, Professor and Doctor. The fifth thesis is that no one needs God to be moral. I only have one quote. It's from 226. It's short. We do not need God in order to be good or evil.
If you think about why you might need God in order to be moral, I can only think of two reasons how that might come about. You might say you need a book to tell you what's moral. Well, as for that, I sincerely hope that nobody in this room bases their morals on the Christian Bible or the Quran. Because if they do, then their morals are likely to be hideous. Needless to say, you can find some decent verses. You can find some decent verses in both the Bible and the Quran, and if you pick and choose those verses, then you can say with hindsight, this verse fits in with my view of what's moral, that verse doesn't, so I'm going to ignore that verse and choose this verse. But you didn't need the Bible in order to do that picking and choosing. You did the picking and choosing on the basis of something else, something which we all have in common, whether we are religious or not. We're all, to a greater or lesser extent, moral, some of us more so than others. Whether we're moral or not has nothing to do with whether we read the Bible. Some people are kind, some people are sympathetic, some people care about suffering, other people don't. It has nothing to do with the Bible. The other reason why you might need religion in order to be moral is that you are either afraid of God, you're afraid if you're not moral you'll get punished, or you're trying to suck up to God and be good so that you'll get a reward. Neither of those two is a very noble reason to be good, to say the least. Now, you might say that forces me into a challenge. How do I know what's moral? Well, I don't on the whole, but the point I want to make is that there does seem to be a kind of universal human acceptance that certain things are right and other things are not. If you look cross-culturally, look at anthropological findings on different cultures, you'll find there's a kind of agreement that certain things are wrong and other things are right. There's disagreement in detail. The golden rule, do as you would be done by. Do unto others what you would expect them to do to you. This is a very, very widespread principle. And it almost amounts to common sense in a way. You certainly don't need a holy book in order to tell you to do that. Now, as an evolutionist, I think that it comes partly from our evolutionary past. I think that there was a time in our history when we lived in small kin groups, and we lived in small groups where good deeds could be expected to be reciprocated. And under those conditions, we developed a kind of lust to be good, which was parallel to the lust for sex, which has obvious Darwinian advantages. Now, we no longer live in small villages, in small clans, and so the Darwinian pressure to be good is no longer so strong, nor is the Darwinian pressure for lust as strong as it once was, because nowadays we often use contraceptives and therefore sexual behavior does not lead to the reproductive consequence, which is, of course, the Darwinian reason for it. But that doesn't matter. The point is that our evolutionary past built into us a lust for sex, and by the same token it built into us a lust to be good, a lust to be to be friendly, a lust to cooperate, a lust to be sympathetic towards suffering. So I think it partly comes from that, but it also comes from something less easy to define, but which is clearly there, because I call it the shifting moral zeitgeist. It's something that changes from decade to decade. Living as we do in 2007, there will be a broad consensus of what's right and wrong. Racism is wrong, sexual discrimination is wrong, cruelty is wrong, which characterize we who live in the early 21st century, which would not necessarily have characterized our ancestors in this place 200 years ago. The consensus has moved on, and I find this a very interesting, fascinating fact, which suggests that there really is a kind of something in the air about what is regarded as moral. And it clearly has nothing to do with religion, because it doesn't come from Scripture. Scripture doesn't change over the decades in the way that our attitudes to slavery, our attitudes to women, etc., do. There really does seem to be a powerful shifting zeitgeist effect, which is doesn't tell you anything in itself, but which indicates that there is something in the air, some other force, something which we can understand with sufficient sociological, psychological sophistication. Whatever else it is, it's not religion.
Dr. Lennox.
The question is, do we need God to be moral? If we formulate it as, can an atheist be good? Of course. Because, as I see it, the very fact that human beings all around the world show a common core of morality is evidence for the truth of the biblical claim that we are moral beings made in the image of God. So what I would want to say is this: of course we can be good without God in the sense of our personal behavior, but I'm not sure whether we can find foundations for the concept of being good without God. You admit that you cannot get ethics from science in your book, A Devil's Chaplain. Science has no methods for deciding what is ethical. And I find it very interesting, reading one of your other books, River Out of Eden, to find what I understand is your analysis of what the universe is like at bottom. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Now that seems to me to be saying that good and evil don't exist, so I don't even know where you get the moral criteria to discuss it. If a rock falls off a mountain onto your head and kills you, it makes no sense calling the rock evil. It just exists. If Pol Pot chooses to eliminate 1 million intellectuals, or the 9/11 terrorists choose to fly hundreds of people to their deaths into the Twin Towers, how can you call them evil if they were simply dancing to their DNA? Now that strikes me as a hideous world you're delivering us into that is no morality at all. And so therefore, just pushing this a little bit further, if good and evil don't exist, there is no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference, how can it possibly make sense to talk of the evils of religion or of the good of atheism? Now, I know that you suggest elsewhere that we have to rebel against our genes, but that creates, to my mind, an immense problem with what you say, because if we are nothing but our genes and dancing to the tune of our DNA, what part of us can rebel against them? So I want to suggest this, that far from atheism delivering an adequate explanation for morality, it dissolves it. And it's a problem that's been around for centuries. How can something mindless and impersonal, like the universe, impose a sense of morality upon us. And David Hume, a philosopher whom you quote, pointed this out very clearly. He said, you just cannot get an ought from an is. You cannot derive morality and ethics from matter and energy. You cannot go from facts to values. And what concerns me greatly is that, although you don't say it in your book, is that this kind of philosophy that has no base for morals in a transcendent God has got to find morality either in raw nature or a combination of nature and society, and often leads to a kind of utilitarianism. And we are in serious ethical confusion, I think, in our contemporary world, in the legal sphere, in the ethical, in the medical sphere, and in the business sphere, because the foundations are crumbling. And I want to suggest, I know it's provocative, but I want to suggest that Dostoevsky was very perceptive, and I've had many Russians agreeing with me, when he said, if God does not exist, everything is permissible. He's not saying that people can't be good. He's saying that the foundations of morality are removed. And Nietzsche predicted exactly the same thing. So I find that trying to get morality elsewhere is something that is doomed to destruction. I would love to spend time discussing the Bible. I think your view of the Bible is a bit one-sided. There are things there to be discussed.
Well, we're about to turn to it.
Okay, fine.
A few minutes left to this live broadcast, the God Delusion Debate.
The last thesis. Christian claims about the person of Jesus are not true. His alleged miracles violate the laws of nature. I'm going to read two excerpts, Professor Dawkins. The first comes from page 92 of your book. The historical evidence that Jesus claimed any sort of divine status is minimal. The next comes from page 257. Jesus was a devotee of the same in-group morality coupled with out-group hostility that was taken for granted in the Old Testament. Jesus was a loyal Jew. It was Paul who invented the idea of taking the Jewish God to the Gentiles. Hartung puts it more bluntly than I dare. Jesus would have turned over in his grave if he had known that Paul would be taking his plan to the pigs.
Once again, I can't let pass. That rhetoric of mine about blind physical forces and indifference and nature neither care, DNA neither cares nor knows. Maybe you're right that that portrays a hideous world. Well, maybe the world is a hideous world. Doesn't make it not true.
No.
That's the fundamental point that I would wish to leave with you, that you can talk till you're blue in the face about how it would be nice if such and such were true. It would be nice if the world were friendly to us. It would be nice if the world was not such a hideous one. But I see it as, first, it tells you nothing about whether it's true or not. We have to decide whether it's true or not separately. It gives us, if it is a hideous world, it gives us something to rise above. And we clearly do rise above it. You raise the question, how do we rebel? And you seem to think there was some kind of contradiction. There is no contradiction with rising above Darwinian dictates. We do it every time we use a contraceptive. It's easy. Every time you use a contraceptive, you are defying the Darwinian imperative to reproduce. You're enjoying sex using the Darwinian, the pleasure that was built into you, into your brains by Darwinism, because normally sex leads to reproduction. You're cutting off that link, and you're using sex for pure enjoyment without reproduction. That's defying, that's rebelling against the selfish genes. And we can do a grand job of rebelling against the hideous, blind physical forces that put us here. We understand what put us here. We understand that we are here as a result of a truly hideous process. Never mind about the effects on humanity. Natural selection, the process which guides evolution, the process whereby...
I'm going to have to cut you off.
Sorry?
I'm going to have to cut you off.
Okay. Natural selection is an ugly process that has beautiful consequences. We humans can rise above it. That's only 2.5 minutes.
Okay. Well, our time has been used a lot by
the
free exchange.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
If you would like to take 30 seconds to wrap up, please.
Well, what about the final wrap-up that we're going to do?
We will do that, and that's our best opportunity if it's still left, Dr. Lennox.
Which question do you want me to refer to?
Well, it's your choice, I guess.
Well, I think I'd like to make a comment on what Richard just said, because I think you are talking about two different things. My point was this, that if you believe that the universe is at bottom, there's no good and evil, you remove from yourself the categories you're using to discuss morality. That's my point. You're assuming it's true. I'm arguing on the basis of its truth that you're removing those categories, and therefore you leave yourself powerless to comment.
Right. You make a good point that I've removed any absolute standard of morality. The empirical fact, however, is that we all very largely share what we regard as morality. And that's a very interesting fact.
It goes much further than that. If that's what you meant, you should have written.
Well,
good or evil is a very strong absolutist statement, I would have thought.
How about...
But I want to refer to this.
How about the topic?
Let me say something about this thesis about the person of Jesus and so on. Again, I have concerns about the God delusion in its treatment of the authority and reliability of Scripture. Because those who've studied it in detail, and I see reference to very few scholars in his book, have come to the conclusion that, say, for example, the historian Luke is one of the most authoritative historians of all ancient history. And Sherwin White of Oxford, a Roman historian, says that it would be absurd to suggest that Luke's basic historicity was false, even in matters of detail. And I'm concerned, too, not only about your attitude to history, Richard, but your description of Jesus as belonging to a person who practiced an in-group morality and out-group hostility, and your interpretation of love your neighbor, which I note doesn't come from a theologian, but from an anesthesiologist, and I think he just might have put you to sleep a little bit as you read it, because in Leviticus, which quotes, love your neighbors yourself, just a bit further down, it says, when a stranger sojourns you with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who lives with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, because you were strangers in Egypt. So in point of historicity, you are totally wrong about the attitude of Jesus. In fact, I would have thought you'd have been very familiar with the parable of the Good Samaritan. And in that parable, it was a Samaritan, one of the strangers, that showed mercy. And that was precisely the parable that Jesus taught to illustrate the love your neighbor as yourself of Leviticus. Now, as a mistake like that seems to me to be very serious indeed. I mean, I react to it a bit like this. What would you think if I got all my views on Darwin from an engineer and never bothered to read The Origin of Species? I think you would be distressed by that. But finally, a word about miracles. This is a massive subject. You claim with David Hume that miracles violate the laws of nature. Well, David Hume's a very curious person to quote on this topic, because David Hume didn't believe really in the laws of cause and effect on which laws of nature are founded. He didn't believe in causality, and he didn't appear to believe in the principle of induction. And so that he's not a very good authority to quote. Secondly, I do not think that miracles are violations of the laws of nature, because the laws of nature describe what normally happens. God, who is the God of this universe and created it with its regularities, is perfectly at liberty to feed a new event into the universe. Just as C.S. Lewis makes a point, if I put $2 plus $2 in my desk tonight, or $4, if I find in the morning there is $1, I don't say that the laws of arithmetic have been broken. I say the laws of Alabama have been broken. and I call for a federal judge.
The federal judge is going to ask that you continue your remarks with the understanding that you really are needing to conclude them within the next couple of minutes to give Professor Dawkins in the last word. There is a broadcast audience. That is part of the reason for our time limits.
Were those meant to be my concluding remarks?
No, I'm giving you an extra minute or so
to make your concluding remarks. My final conclusion for the night.
Before giving the last word to Professor Dawkins.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been an interesting discussion. I'll have to make my remarks very briefly. I do not think the answer is atheism, though I agree with much of the criticism that Richard makes of religion. I think the book The God Delusion gives the game away in the dedication at the front of the book to Douglas Adams, where he says, isn't it enough to see that a garden is beautiful without having to believe that there are fairies at the bottom of it too? Now, you do a brilliant job at getting rid of the fairies, though it must be said that most of them didn't believe in them anyway. But when you see the beauty of a garden, say a New College in Oxford, do you believe there's no gardener or no owner? That its sublime beauty has come about from raw nature by pure chance? Of course not. For gardens are to be distinguished from raw nature by the operation of intelligence. And what you're doing in your book, I think, is presenting us with an obviously false set of alternatives. Either we take gardens on their own or the garden plus fairies. But they don't appear on their own. They have gardeners and owners. So does the universe. You say there's no evidence of God, and yet your very description of the universe as a garden bears witness that the evidence is all around you. Atheism, ladies and gentlemen, is not only false, it contains no message that deals with the central problem of human rebellion against God. History is littered with attempts to build a godless utopia, each one of them based, as the book of Genesis suggests that they would be, on a denial that God has ever spoken, or even that he exists. And I would remind you that the world that Richard Dawkins wishes to bring us to is no paradise except for the few. It denies the existence of good and evil. It even denies justice. But ladies and gentlemen, our hearts cry out for justice. And centuries ago, the Apostle Paul spoke to the philosophers of Athens and pointed out that there would be a day in which God would judge the world by the man that he had appointed, Jesus Christ, and that he'd given assurance to all people by raising him from the dead. And the resurrection of Jesus Christ, a miracle, something supernatural, for me constitutes the central evidence upon which I base my faith, not only that atheism is a delusion, but that justice is real and our sense of morality does not mock us. Because if there is no resurrection, if there is nothing after death, in the end the terrorists and the fanatics have got away with it.
Okay. Thank you. Hey. Professor Dawkins.
Yes, well, that concluding bit rather gives the game away, doesn't it? All that stuff about science and physics and the complications of physics and things, what it really comes down to is the resurrection of Jesus. I mean, there's a fundamental incompatibility between the sort of sophisticated scientist, which we hear part of the time from John Lennox, and it's impressive, and we are interested in the argument about multiverses and things. And then having produced some sort of a case for a kind of deistic God, perhaps, some God, the great physicist who adjusted the laws and constants of the universe. That's all very grand and wonderful. And then suddenly we come down to the resurrection of Jesus. It's so petty, it's so trivial, it's so local, it's so earthbound, it's so unworthy of the universe. When we go into a garden and we see how beautiful it is, and we see coloured flowers, and we see the butterflies and the bees, of course it's natural to think there must be a gardener. Any fool is likely to think there must be a gardener. The huge achievement of Darwin was to show that didn't have to be true. Of course it's difficult. Of course it had to wait until the mid-19th century before anybody thought of it. It seems so obvious that if you've got a garden, there must be a gardener who created it and all that goes with that. What Darwin did was to show the staggeringly counterintuitive fact that this not only can be explained by an undirected process. It's not chance, by the way. Entirely wrong to say it's chance. It's not chance. Natural selection is the very opposite of chance, and that's the essence of it. That was what Darwin discovered. He showed not only a garden, but everything in the living world, and in principle not just on this earth, but on any other planet, wherever you see the organized complexity that we understand, that we call life, that it has an explanation which can derive it from simple beginnings by comprehensible rational means. That is possibly the greatest achievement that any human mind has ever accomplished. Not only did he show that it could be done, I believe that we can argue that that the alternative is so unparsimonious and so counter to the laws of common sense that, reluctant as we might be, because it might be unpleasant for us to admit it, although we can't disprove that there's a God, it is very, very unlikely indeed.
We are told that in the earlier part of the last century that G.K. Chesterton and George Bernard Shaw engaged in a lively but friendly debate. It may be said that perhaps we haven't seen anything quite like that until tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking them.
You've been listening to a live broadcast of the God Delusion debate between Richard Dawkins and John Lennox. I'm Wayne Shepherd with Dave Zanotti. We'll keep it here for just a few more minutes. We've been observers here tonight listening, Dave, so let's make some observations.
Wayne, one of the things we're most concerned about is that people are able to unpack what they've just experienced, because this wasn't just a debate. This was, in fact, an experience.
Mm-hmm.
What's actually happened here has been the collision of worldviews that was anticipated. We've had a significant unpacking of Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, and Professor Lennox's response in his book, God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God? Now, so first thing we want to say to people is you're probably going to want to take this in bits and pieces and re-listen again. There is a DVD and a CD that's going to be available through Fixed Point Foundation that people can get their hands on. We'll talk about that in just a moment.
Yeah, I'll give the website now for that. It's Fixed Point, and there's a hyphen between those two words, fixed-point.org, and there'll be information, obviously, on the website how you can order a copy of this debate. It's my understanding that it will not be archived anywhere on the Internet, so I want our listeners to know that, and I'm grateful that you were listening tonight and joined us for the live broadcast.
Now, we'll be unpacking this in some future programming on the public square,
right.
And that's yet to come. It'll take a little while to put those pieces together, but we'll be talking more with John Lennox particularly about this.
So keep coming back to the website, aproundtable.org. By the way, that website is up and operable right now for your comments to the debate tonight. Many of you have been commenting during the debate, and we thank you for all of those. We've been reading them as they've been coming in. Lots of observations,
well,
helpful.
And a little bit of frustration because people want more.
Yes, right,
which is encouraging. And I would tell people that both books are legible. They're both books that are not over people's heads. Just because we have two professors from Oxford University, they write in ways that are easy to understand. Mm-hmm. So people can unpack this at the retail level, if you will. You don't have to be a PhD to get this stuff.
Yeah. Right. Debates can be tricky. You need structure, but at the same time, you don't want the structure to get in the way of that lively exchange.
And being here in the hall, I want to tell you that you heard their voices, and their voices are unique and winsome. There was excellent dialogue between the two characters,
yes.
And it was friendly. It was very much like we had been transported to Oxford, and the two of them were sort of sitting with two little podiums in the
mm-hmm.
classroom in between
mm-hmm.
and really applying their wares, working their trade.
The format tonight followed the various theses in the book, The God Delusion. Let's kind of take a look at a couple of those for a moment. Go ahead.
Wayne, one of the things that kept coming back over and over again was Dr. Lennox's profound real-world experiences in the Soviet Union and among totalitarian regimes,
right,
among those who were the greatest advocates of atheism in the 20th century. I'm mindful of a quote by Donald Fetter of the Boston Herald, or the Globe at that time.
Boston
this
Globe.
Is for Globe. And at the end of his article, he said it was as if humanity had stepped back from the 70 years of the godless abyss at the crashing of the Soviet Empire. There's no question that people were there understood that it was godlessness that was the operational platform of the Soviet Empire and the extinction of a theistic viewpoint. So Dr. Lennox, coming back to those real-world examples, and it seemed that at that point, Professor Dawkins continued to struggle from the theoretical to the real.
Yeah, that flowed from the part of the book that no one needs God to be moral, and that was the exchange that followed that particular statement of thesis from Richard Dawkins here tonight. And I, too, found that to be the highlight of the evening, to hear the arguments on both sides as presented by both men. But in a sense, it left me wanting more.
Certainly.
And you need to investigate these things. And that's the reason that a debate like tonight can be so stimulating, is it can get us going. It can prompt us to want. It can whet our appetite. We want more.
One man was saying faith requires no evidence, therefore is logically inconsistent. The other man was saying my faith is based upon the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
That's a collision. That's a collision of worldviews and a collision of perspective. I have to tell you, I heard with my own ears Professor Dawkins saying that, quote, we don't know the origins of the universe. I think that's a monstrously big statement.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know the origins of the universe, coming from someone advocating, as they said, evolution all night long, the way that they do.
The British way.
Yeah. He went on again to another place to say that Darwin does not explain the origin of the universe. Once again, a very specific quotation. And as they continued to come back to that question, it accelerated. Now, interestingly enough, Professor Dawkins does not come and debate on the question of science and creationism. He will not participate in that. But tonight, he was the one who brought up creation versus evolution to the debate.
Mm-hmm.
I found that fascinating. Mm-hmm.
You were taking copious notes. We're going to come back to that in just a moment. I do want to point out that the website aproundtable.org is a place where you can file your comments. Do that even now on the heels of tonight's live broadcast, this debate between Richard Dawkins and John Lennox. Go to aproundtable.org, click on comments. You can submit your own comment, and you can read the comments of others. Now, also, you can click on Ask John Lennox a Question. We have that there because we will have, as Dave said earlier, the opportunity over the next few weeks to talk to John
and
in the studio.
And if we're able to be able to talk to Professor Dawkins, we will do the same.
That's right.
Please, no one should think that there's any intention here of ganging up on one or the other.
Right.
We deeply appreciate the fact that both these scholars came to this environment in a free dialogue.
Didn't you find it interesting that the audience seemed to be fairly evenly divided between the viewpoints tonight.
And at times, I think the audience, in a collegiate atmosphere, I think the audience was preferential toward Professor Dawkins.
Mm-hmm.
I found that from being in the hall. I think that was pretty much because
than Southern hospitality.
I think so. I have to bring up one point. I'd be remiss not to say I was fascinated by Professor Dawkins' terminology that Darwin has given to the human race a lust to be good.
Yes.
I've got to do more research on that one. I found that one. I'm sorry. Forgive me. That one got me laughing. It just sounded so strange to my ears. Now, I'm willing to learn, but a lust to be good. And that it came from the fact that there was a time we lived in small kin groups and that somehow we've lost that.
Yeah. That good deeds were rewarded. And mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wayne, bottom line. What we had in the collision of the worldviews was one man saying basically the earth is flat. Mm-hmm. That was the atheistic perspective. That in essence, the world is flatlined. What is here is here. And another man saying, wait, there must be more. There must be a transcendent reality. So a flat earth versus a transcendent or a more vertical worldview. And those two things did crash. They crashed on personal ethics. They crashed on geopolitics. They crashed on history, they crashed on evidence, and we had a biologist and a professor of philosophy of mathematics, and that showed their, that in their specific studies, they had come to different worldviews as well.
One thing that Professor Dawkins said tonight, and I didn't write down the exact quotation, but he said something to the effect that is a great gift to give our children the gift of skepticism. How do you respond to that?
To that I say amen. I don't think anyone should accept, excuse me, this is live radio. I don't think anyone should accept a truth claim simply because they have been told it, no matter who it was that told them the truth claim. I think that we must first start with an honest, open mind of skepticism, mm-hmm. and then seek and search for truth.
And John Lennox also denounced the evil that has been done in the name of religion.
Sure.
He cited the Crusades as one example, but there have been many, of course.
Well, I think both men were agreeing, but the problem that comes back is something that Dr. Francis Schaeffer brought forward often, that in a world where there is no God, there is not a reason why to distinguish between cruelty and non-cruelty. And that's another place where the argument seemed to stumble for Professor Dawkins, is that the question of good and evil, which he acknowledged exists, but then you come to the answer of, then why should people be non-cruel? And we come back to that lust to be good, which when I consider Columbine and I consider Virginia Tech and I consider 9/11 and I consider Nazi Germany and I consider the Soviet Union and Pol Pot, I'm hard-pressed to say that the world is getting better,
mm-hmm.
because we want it that way.
We have a minute or so left, and there was so much that happened here tonight that we can't comment on everything. The moment where they talked about science supporting atheism, not Christianity, had some interesting exchanges as well. I don't know if you have any notes in front of you about...
Other than the fact that I found the two men delightful. I find their voices delightful, I find the interchange delightful, and I do want to hear more.
And the two men had never... They both are Oxford dons. They're at Oxford University in England, but they had never met before
place.
Tonight.
Yeah,
I
and some
so.
Big minds.
I guess so. Well, we have just a minute left, and again, I want to encourage you to go to the... we have a couple minutes left, actually, Dave, and I want to encourage our listeners, please, it doesn't matter to us which side at this point of the debate you're on, because we want to hear from all sides.
Sure.
We want to hear your honest reaction mm-hmm. to the debate tonight. As I said, we've been observers here, and the Fixed Point Foundation has sponsored this debate, and they've given us the privilege, really, of broadcasting this debate to the nation.
Well, and in the spirit of full disclosure, I don't think it comes as a surprise that anyone listening would know that you and I are both professing biblical Christians.
Yes.
All right. But at the same time, as honest Americans, we certainly want Professor Dawkins to have every opportunity at free speech.
Right.
And the right to his opinion.
Right. Remember, we look forward to your comments. You can post them to us on the internet at aproundtable.org. Or you can post questions. On the website it says for John Lennox, but you can put a question there for Richard Dawkins as well if you like. If we ever have the opportunity to present that question to him, we certainly will. aproundtable.org.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the special presentation of the God Delusion Debate here on M88 and on Raw Talk. Now, keep in mind, any opinions that were expressed during this debate are not the opinions of the staff or management of M88 or Calvary of Albuquerque. This was just a special presentation of a debate that took place earlier this year. So keep that in mind when you consider some of the opinions and the statements that were made during this particular debate. Thanks so much for joining us for this special presentation of Raw Talk, and I hope you all have a very safe and a very happy new year. Join us again next Sunday, and we'll talk a little bit about what we're resolving to do in 2008. Hope you'll join me and call in during Raw Talk next Sunday night at 7 p.m. here on M88.